do with politics, and he'd taken the sewer as his place of residence and had a key to it. It was, I repeat, the 6th of June. It could have been 8 o'clock in the evening. The man heard a noise in the sewer. He was pretty startled, and he hugged the wall and watched. It was the noise of footsteps. Someone was walking in the shadows. Someone was coming his way. The funny thing was that there was another man in the sewer. Someone other than himself. The sewer exit was not far away. A bit of light coming through the gate allowed him to recognize the newcomer and to see that the man was carrying something on his back. He was walking hunched over. The man walking hunched over was an ex-convict, and what he was lugging on his shoulders was a corpse. Case of being caught red-handed in the act of murder, if ever there was one. As for the theft, it goes without saying, you don't kill a man for free. The convict was going to throw the corpse in the river. A fact to note is that before reaching the exit gate, the convict, who came from way down the sewer, had to have encountered a dreadful bog where it would seem he could well have left the corpse, but the very next day, the sewer workers working on the quagmire would have found the murdered man, and that was not how the murderer wanted it. He preferred to get through the bog with his burden, and he must have worked horribly hard at it. You could not put your life more completely at risk. I don't understand how he got out of there alive. Malthus's chair came even closer. Thénardier took advantage of this to take a deep breath. He pursued. Monsieur le Baron, a sewer is not the Champ de Mars. There's nothing there, not even room. When there are two men in there, they have to run into each other. And that's what happened. The resident and the man passing through were forced to say hello to each other, regretfully, on both sides. The blow-in said to the resident, "You can see what's on my back. I've got to get out. You have the key. Give it to me." This convict was a man of terrible strength. There was no refusing him. Yet the one with the key parleyed solely to gain time. He examined the dead man, but he couldn't see anything except that he was young, well turned out, apparently rich, and all disfigured by blood. While he chatted, he was able to tear off a piece of the murdered man's coat at the back without the murderer being any the wiser. Supporting evidence, you understand. A way of getting back on the trail of things and pinning the crime on the criminal. He put the supporting evidence in his pocket, after which he opened the gate, let the man out with his load on his back, shut the gate again, and bolted, not caring too much to get mixed up in the episode as it happens, and especially not wanting to be there when the murderer chucked his victim into the river. Now, you get it. The one lugging the corpse is Jean Valjean. The one with the key is speaking to you at this very moment, and the bit of coat... Thénardier finished his sentence by pulling out of his pocket and flourishing at eye level, between both thumbs and forefingers, a strip of black cloth that was in shreds and covered with dark stains. Marius had got to his feet, pale, barely breathing, his eyes fixed on the piece of black cloth, and, without uttering a word, without taking his eyes off this tatter, he backed toward the wall and, with his right hand stretched out behind him, groped for the key in the lock of a cupboard next to the fireplace. He found the key, opened the cupboard, and thrust his arm in without looking and without taking his startled eyes off the fragment of cloth Thénardier held up. Meanwhile, Thénardier went on. "Monsieur le Baron, I have very good reason to think that the young man assassinated was a wealthy foreigner, lured by Jean Valjean into a trap while he was carrying an enormous sum on him." "The young man was me, and here is the coat," cried Malthus as he threw an old black coat all covered in blood on the parquet floor. Then, ripping the fragment out of Thénardier's hands, he crouched over the coat and brought the torn fragment to the mutilated panel. The tear fitted perfectly, the strip completed the coat. Thénardier was petrified. What he thought was, I'll be buggered. Marius straightened up, shivering, desperate, radiant. He fumbled in his pocket and strode furious over to Thénardier, handing him, practically ramming into his face, a fist filled with notes of 500 francs and 1,000 francs. You are a thorough bastard. You are a liar, a defamer, a cur. You came to accuse a man, but you've only vindicated him. You wanted to sink him, but you've only succeeded in glorifying him. You are the thief. You are the murderer. I saw you, Thénardier Jondrette, in that hole on the Boulevard de l'Hôpital. I've got enough on you to send you to jail and beyond, if I wanted to. Here's 1,000 francs, racketeer scum that you are. And he threw 1,000-franc note at Thénardier. Ah, Jondrette Thénardier, vile reprobate! Let this be a lesson to you, you peddler of secrets, mystery merchant, rummager in the dark, miserable bastard. Take these 500 francs while you're at it and get out. Waterloo is the only thing saving your hide. Waterloo! Snorted Thénardier, pocketing the 500 francs along with 1,000 francs. Yes, you murderous swine, you saved the life of a colonel. A general! Said Thénardier, lifting his head. A colonel! Marius shot back in a fit of rage. I wouldn't give 2 hoots for a general. And to think you came here to commit your evil deeds. I tell you, you have committed every crime in the book. Get out of my sight. Go and crawl under a rock. Just be happy, that's all I ask. You monster, here's another 3,000 francs. Take it. You'll leave tomorrow, at the latest, for America, with your daughter, for your wife is dead, you lying worm. I'll see to it that you set sail, you crook, and I'll count you out 20,000 francs at the dock. Go and get yourself hanged somewhere else. Monsieur le Baron, replied Thénardier, bowing to the ground, eternal gratitude. And Thénardier scuttled away, comprehending nothing, stunned and thrilled at this soft pummeling with bags of gold, this thunderclap bursting over his head in banknotes. Thunderstruck he was, but content, too. And he would have been very sorry to have had a lightning rod to protect him against this particular bolt from the blue. Let's wash our hands of the man without further ado. 2 days after the events we are relating at the moment, he left, thanks to Marius, for America, under a false name, with his daughter Azelma, armed with a draft for 20,000 francs to be drawn in New York. The moral destitution of Thénardier, that bourgeois manqué, was irremediable. He was in America what he had been in Europe. Contact with a mean man is sometimes all it takes to corrupt a good deed and cause something bad to spring from it. With the money from Marius, Thénardier made himself a slave trader. As soon as Thénardier was out the door, Marius ran to the garden where Cosette was still ambling. Cosette! Cosette! He yelled. Come, come quickly, we must get cracking. Basque, a fiacre! Cosette, hurry! Oh, my God, he was the one who saved my life! We mustn't lose a minute. Put your shawl on. Cosette thought he'd gone mad, and did as she was told. He couldn't breathe. He placed his hand on his heart to slow the beating. He paced to and fro with great strides. He kissed Cosette. Ah, Cosette, what a sorry man I am, he said. Marius was overcome. He began to have an inkling of how incredibly lofty and solemn a figure this Jean Valjean was. An unheard-of virtue appeared to him, supreme and meek, humble in its immensity. The convict was transfigured into Christ. Marius was completely dazzled by this wonder. He did not know exactly what he saw, only that it was great. In an instant, a fiacre was at the door. Marius handed Cosette up and leaped in. Driver, he said, Rue de l'Homme Armé, No. 7. The fiacre set off. Ah, what happiness, said Cosette. Rue de l'Homme Armé, I didn't dare bring it up any more. We're going to see Monsieur Jean. Your father, Cosette, your father more than ever. Cosette, I think I can guess what happened. You told me you never got the letter I sent you via Gavroche. It must have fallen into his hands. Cosette, he went to the barricade to save me. As his great need is to be an angel just like that, in passing, he saved others there. He saved Javert. He pulled me out of that inferno in order to hand me to you. He carried me on his back through that appalling sewer. Ah, I'm a monstrous ingrate. Cosette, after being your salvation, he was mine. Just imagine, there was an awful quagmire, one you could drown in 100 times over, one that could drown you in the sludge. Cosette, he got me through it. I'd passed out, I saw nothing, I heard nothing. I didn't have a clue what was happening to me. We're going to bring him back. Have him here with us, whether he likes it or not. He won't be leaving us ever again. Let's hope he's at home. Let's hope we find him. I'll spend the rest of my life at his feet. Yes, that must be it, you see, Cosette. Gavroche must have handed my letter to him instead of you. That explains everything, you understand? Cosette did not understand a word. You're right, she said. Meanwhile, the fiacre rolled along. Night with day behind it. At the knock he heard at his door, Jean Valjean turned round. "Come in," he croaked. The door opened. Cosette and Marius appeared. Cosette rushed into the room. Marius stayed on the landing, leaning against the doorway. "Cosette," said Jean Valjean, and he rose in his chair, his arms open wide, and shaking, haggard, pale, looking like death, but with an immense joy in his eyes. Cosette, choked with emotion, fell on Jean Valjean's breast. "Father," she said. Jean Valjean was overwhelmed. He stuttered, "Cosette, it's her, you, madame, it's you, oh God." And hugged tight in Cosette's arms, he cried, "It's you, you're here, so you forgive me." Marius closed his eyes to stop the tears flowing, took a step forward, and murmured between lips convulsively pressed together to stop the sobs, "My father!" "And you, too, you forgive me," said Jean Valjean. Marius could find no words, and Jean Valjean spoke again, "Thank you." Cosette tore off her shawl and threw her hat on the bed. "They're in the way." And sitting on the old man's knees, she brushed aside his white hair in the sweetest gesture and kissed his forehead. Jean Valjean just sat there, bewildered. Cosette, who had only a very dim idea of what was going on, kissed him and caressed him more intently, as though she wanted to pay off Marius's debt. Jean Valjean stammered, "How stupid can you be? I thought I'd never see her again. Just imagine, Monsieur Pontmercy, the moment you came in I was saying to myself, 'It's finished. There's her little dress.' I am a miserable man. I'll never see Cosette again. I was saying that the very moment you were coming up the stairs. What an idiot I was. See what an idiot I am. But we don't take the good Lord into account. The good Lord says, 'You think they're going to abandon you, nincompoop.' No, no, that's not how it's going to happen. Let's see, there's a poor old man that needs an angel, and the angel comes, and a man sees his Cosette again, a man sees his little Cosette again. I was so unhappy." For a moment he could not speak. Then he went on. "I really did need to see Cosette for just a moment, from time to time. A heart needs a bone to gnaw on. But I was all too well aware I wasn't wanted. I resigned myself to it. They don't need you. Stay in your corner. A man doesn't have the right to go on forever. Ah, God be blessed, I'm seeing her again. You know, Cosette, your husband is very handsome. That's a pretty embroidered collar you have there. Lovely. I like that pattern. Your husband chose it, didn't he? And then you must have cashmeres. Monsieur Pontmercy, let me call her Cosette. It won't be for long." And Cosette came back. "How mean to have left us like that. Where on earth did you go? Why did you stay away so long? Once your trips only lasted 3 or 4 days. I sent Nicolette over, but they always told her he's away. How long have you been back? Why didn't you let us know? Do you know you've changed a lot? Ah, wicked father. He was sick, and we didn't know. Here, Marius, feel how cold his hand is."
"So here you are. Monsieur Pontmercy, you forgive me," Jean Valjean repeated.
At those words, coming once more from Jean Valjean, all that was welling up in Marius's heart found an outlet, and he burst out, "Cosette, do you hear that? Typical, he asks me to forgive him. And do you know what he did for me, Cosette? He saved my life. He did more than that, he gave me you. And after saving me and after giving me you, Cosette, what did he do with himself? He sacrificed himself. That's the kind of man he is. And to me, the oblivious, the pitiless, the guilty, the ungrateful wretch, he says, 'Thank you.' Cosette, if I spent my whole life at this man's feet, it would be too little. The barricade, the sewer, the furnace, the cesspit, he went through it all for me, for you, Cosette. He carried me through every form of death, driving death away from me and accepting it for himself. Every form of courage, every form of virtue, every form of heroism, every form of saintliness, he has the lot. Cosette, this man is an angel."
"Shh, shh," Jean Valjean whispered. "Why say all that?"
"But what about you?" shouted Marius, with a fury verging on veneration. "Why didn't you say anything? It's your fault, too. You save people's lives, and you hide it from them. You do more than that. You slander yourself while you're pretending to unmask yourself. It's appalling."
"I told the truth," answered Jean Valjean.
"No," Marius retorted. The truth is the whole truth, and that you did not tell. You were Monsieur Madeleine. Why didn't you say so? You saved Javert. Why didn't you say so? I owe my life to you. Why didn't you say so?
Because I thought as you did. I felt you were right. I had to go away. If you'd known about that sewer business, you would have made me stay with you, so I had to keep quiet. If I had spoken out, it would have upset everything.
Upset what? Upset who? Returned Marius. You don't think you're going to stay here, do you? You're coming with us. My God, when I think it was only by accident that I learned all this. You're coming with us. You are part of us. You are her father and mine. You're not spending another day in this hellhole of a place. Don't imagine that you'll still be here tomorrow.
Tomorrow, said Jean Valjean, I won't be here. But I won't be at your place, either.
What do you mean by that? Replied Marius. Oh, no, we won't allow any more trips. You're not leaving us again. You belong to us. We won't let you go. This time it's for keeps, chipped in Cosette. We have a carriage down below. I'm kidnapping you. If necessary, I'll use force. And laughing, she made as though to lift the old man up in her arms. Your room's still there at our place, she went on. If you only knew how lovely the garden is at the moment. The azaleas are coming along nicely. The paths are all sanded with river sand. There are little violet-colored shells in it. You'll eat my strawberries. I water them myself. And no more Madame and no more Monsieur Jean. We are in a republic. Everybody says tu, don't they, Marius? There's been a change of program. If you only knew, Father, I had a terrible thing happen. There was a robin redbreast that had built its nest in a hole in the wall, and a horrible cat went and ate it on me. My poor pretty little robin redbreast, who used to stick its head in the window and look at me. I cried over it. I could have killed the cat. But no one is going to cry any more now. Everyone is going to laugh. Everyone is going to be happy. You're going to come with us. Grandfather will be so pleased. You'll have your patch in the garden. You'll grow things in it. And we'll see if your strawberries are as good as mine. And then I'll do whatever you like, and you'll do whatever I say.
Jean Valjean listened to her, without understanding what she was saying. He was listening to the music of her voice more than the meaning of her words. One of those big tears, which are the somber pearls of the soul, slowly gathered in his eye. He murmured, The proof that God is good is that she is here.
My darling father, said Cosette.
Jean Valjean went on.
It's all too true that it would be lovely to live together. They have trees full of birds. I'd stroll around with Cosette. To be one of the living, say, good morning to each other, call out to each other in the garden. How sweet that is. We'd see each other from first thing in the morning. We'd each have our own little corner. She would get me to eat her strawberries. I would get her to pick my roses. It would be lovely. Only...
He broke off and said softly,
What a shame.
The tear did not fall. It went back in. And Jean Valjean replaced it with a smile. Cosette took both the old man's hands in hers.
My God, she said, your hands are even colder. Are you sick? Are you in pain?
Me? No, answered Jean Valjean. I feel very well. Only...
He stopped himself.
Only what?
I'm going to die in a little while. Cosette and Marius shuddered.
To die?
Cried Marius.
Yes, but that's nothing, said Jean Valjean.
He took a breath, smiled, and went on.
Cosette, you were talking to me. Go on. Talk some more. So, your little robin redbreast is dead. Talk, so I can hear your voice.
Marius looked at the old man, petrified. Cosette let out a heart-rending cry.
Father, my darling father, you shall live. You are going to live. I want you to live. Do you hear me?
Jean Valjean lifted his head to her in adoration.
Ah, yes. Forbid me to die. Who knows? Perhaps I'll obey. I was dying when you arrived. That stopped me. I felt like I was born again.
You're full of strength and life, cried Marius.
You don't really imagine that people die just like that. You've had your sorrows. You won't have any more. It is I who beg your forgiveness and on my knees to boot. You are going to live and to live with us, and to live a long time. We'll take you home. There are two of us here who will have only one thought from now on, your happiness. You see, Cosette said in tears, Marius says you won't die.
Jean Valjean went on smiling. If you were to take me back, Monsieur Pelmercy, would that mean I was not what I am? No. God thought the same as you and I did, and he doesn't change his mind. It's best that I take myself off. Death is a good arrangement. God knows better than we do what we need, that you be happy that Monsieur Pontmercy have Cosette, that youth marry mourning, that there be lilacs and nightingales around you, my children, that your life be a beautiful lawn in sunlight, that all the enchantments of heaven fill your soul, and that now I who am good for nothing, I die. All this is surely only right and good. You see, be reasonable. There's nothing left now. I feel absolutely sure that it's over. An hour ago I fainted, and then last night I drank that pitcher full of water over there. How good your husband is, Cosette. You're much better off with him than with me.
There was a noise at the door. It was the doctor coming in.
Hello, and goodbye, said Jean Valjean. Here are my poor children.
Marius went over to the doctor. He addressed this single word to him. Monsieur? But the way he said it involved the whole question. The doctor answered that question with a glance that said it all.
Just because you don't like the way things are, said Jean Valjean, that's no reason to be unfair to God.
There was a silence. All hearts were heavy. Jean Valjean turned to Cosette. He began to contemplate her as though he wanted to take her in for all eternity. Even at the dark depth to which he had already descended, he could still feel ecstasy in gazing at Cosette. The glow from that sweet face lit up his own pale face. Even at death's door, a person can still be dazzled. The doctor felt his pulse.
Ah, it's you that he needed,
he murmured, looking at Cosette and Marius. And, bending over to Marius's ear, he whispered, Too late. Jean Valjean, almost without ceasing to gaze at Cosette, considered Marius and the doctor with serenity. They heard these words, barely audible, come from his lips.
Dying is nothing. What's terrible is not to live.
All of a sudden he stood up. These surges of strength are sometimes a sign of dying. He walked with firm tread to the wall, pushed Marius and the doctor aside when they tried to help him, took down the small copper crucifix from the wall where it was hanging, came back and sat down with all the ease of movement of a man in his prime, and said in a loud voice, laying the crucifix on the table, There is the great martyr. Then his chest sank, his head swayed, as though the intoxication of the grave had taken hold of him, and his hands, lying on his knees, began to claw at the fabric of his trousers. Cosette held him by the shoulders and sobbed and tried to talk to him, but could not do it. Among the words that mingled with that mournful saliva that accompanies tears, they could make out words such as these, Father, don't leave us. Can we really have found you again only to lose you? It could be said that death meanders in its throes. It comes and goes, moves toward the grave, then turns back toward life. There is groping in the act of dying. Jean Valjean gathered strength again after this semi-blackout, shook his head as though to shake off the dark, and became almost completely lucid again. He grabbed a piece of Cosette's sleeve and kissed it. He's coming back! Doctor, he's coming back! Cried Marius.
You are good, the two of you, said Jean Valjean. I'll tell you what hurt me, Monsieur Pontmercy, is that you didn't want to touch the money. That money really is your wife's. I'm going to explain to you, my children. That's even the real reason I'm so pleased to see you. Black jet comes from England. White jet comes from Norway. All of this is in that note over there that you'll read. For bracelets, I invented a way of replacing soldered metal loops with slightly open metal loops. It's prettier, better, and cheaper. You see all the money that can be made. Cosette's fortune is well and truly hers. I give you these details to put your minds at rest. The concierge had come up and was watching by the door, which was ajar. The doctor sent her away, but he could not prevent the good woman from calling out to the dying man before she disappeared. "Would you like a priest?"
"I have one," said Jean Valjean.
And with his finger, he seemed to be pointing to a spot above his head where you would have sworn he saw someone. It is likely, in fact, that the bishop was there with him in his agony. Cosette gently slid a pillow behind his back. Jean Valjean went on.
"Monsieur Pontmercy, have no fear, I implore you. The 600,000 francs really are Cosette's. I'll have lived my life in vain if you don't enjoy them. We got to the stage where we were turning out very good glass beads. We could compete with what is known as Berlin jewelry. You can't, for instance, equal the black glass of Germany, a gross which contains 1,200 well-cut stones. Only costs 3 francs. When a being that is dear to us is about to die, you look at them with a look that clings to them in an effort to hold them back. Both Cosette and Marius, speechless with anguish, not knowing what to say to death, desperate and trembling, stood before him, Cosette giving Marius her hand. Jean Valjean was fading fast, from one moment to the next. He was going down. He was getting closer to that dark horizon. His breath had become intermittent, broken up by a faint death rattle. He had trouble moving his arm. His feet had lost all movement, and at the same time, as the misery of his limbs and the crushing of his body was growing, all the majesty of his soul was rising and unfurling across his forehead. The light of the unknown world was already visible in his eyes. His face grew white, and at the same time he smiled. Life was no longer there. There was something else. His breath died away. His gaze widened. He was a corpse with wings you could feel. He signaled to Cosette to approach, then to Marius. It was clearly the final minute of the final hour, and he began to talk to them in a voice so weak it seemed to come from far away, and from that moment it was as though there was a wall between them and him. "Come here. Come here, both of you. I love you dearly. Oh, it's good to die this way. You, too, you love me, my Cosette. I knew all along that you still felt affection for your good old boy. How sweet of you to have put that pillow behind my back. You will cry for me a bit, won't you? Not too much. I don't want you to be overcome with sorrow. You must live life to the hilt, my children. I forgot to tell you, you make even more on the buckles without tongues than on all the rest. The gross, the 12 dozen used to cost 10 francs and sell for 60, it really was a good business, so you really shouldn't be surprised at that 600,000 francs, Monsieur Pontmercy. It's honest money. You can be rich in all tranquility. You must have a carriage, from time to time a box at the theatre, beautiful ball gowns, my Cosette. And then give your good friends good dinners. Be very happy. I was writing to Cosette a moment ago. She'll find my letter. It is to her that I bequeath those 2 candlesticks on the mantelpiece. They're silver, but for me they are gold. They are diamond. They change the candles you put in them into altar candles. I don't know if the man who gave them to me is pleased with me up there. I did what I could. My children, you won't forget that I'm a pauper. You'll bury me in the first plot of ground you come across, beneath a stone to mark the spot. That is my wish. No name on the stone. If Cosette wants to come and see me for a while sometimes, it will make me happy. You too, Monsieur Pontmercy, I have to confess, I have not always loved you. Forgive me, please. Now the two of you are but one for me. I am very grateful to you. I feel that you make Cosette happy. If you only knew Monsieur Pontmercy, her beautiful rosy cheeks, they were my joy in life. Whenever I saw her a bit pale, I was sad. There's a 500-franc note in the chest of drawers. I haven't touched it. It's for the poor. Cosette, you see your little dress over there on the bed. Do you recognize it? Yet it's only 10 years ago. How time flies. We have been pretty happy. It's over. My children, don't cry. I'm not going far. I'll see you from there. You'll only have to look up at night and you'll see me smile. Cosette, do you remember Montfermeil? You were in the woods. You were scared stiff. Do you remember how I took the handle of the bucket? That was the first time I touched your poor little hand. It was so cold. Ah, you had red hands in those days, mademoiselle. They are nice and white now. And the big doll. Do you remember? You called her Catherine. You were sorry you didn't bring her to the convent. How you made me laugh at times, my sweet angel. When it rained, you used to launch bits of straw in the gutters and watch them sail away. One day, I gave you a wickerwork bat and a shuttlecock with yellow, blue, and green feathers. You've forgotten it, I know. You were so mischievous when you were little. You were always playing. You'd stick cherries over your ears. That's all in the past. The forests where you went with your little girl. The trees where we would stroll. The convents where we hid. The games. The good hard laughs of childhood that is shadow now. I thought all that belonged to me. That's where I was so stupid. Those Thénardiers were a nasty lot. You must forgive them. Cosette, the time has come to tell you your mother's name. Her name was Fantine. Hang on to that name, Fantine. Go down on your knees every time you say it. She suffered so much. She loved you dearly. She had as much unhappiness as you have happiness. Those are God's lots. He is up there. He sees every one of us. And he knows what he's doing up there in the middle of his great stars. So I'm going away, my children. Love one another dearly, always. Nothing else in the world really matters but that. To love one another. You will think sometimes of the poor old man who died here. Oh, my Cosette, it's not my fault, is it, if I didn't see you all this time lately? It broke my heart. I would go just to the corner of your street. I must have had quite an effect on the people who saw me go by. I was like a madman once I went out without a hat. My children, I can't see too clearly any more now. I still had things to say, but never mind. Think of me sometimes. You are among the blessed. I don't know what's the matter with me. I see light. Come closer. I die happy. Give me your dearly beloved heads, so I can lay my hands on them.
Cosette and Marius fell to their knees, distraught, choking with tears, each with one of Jean Valjean's hands on their head. Those august hands no longer stirred. He had fallen backward. The light from the two candlesticks shone on him. His white face looked up at the sky. He let Cosette and Marius cover his hands with kisses. He was dead. The night was starless and black as pitch. Doubtless in the dark, some vast angel was
standing by with wings outspread, waiting for his soul.
The grass hides, and the rain erases. In the cemetery of Père Lachaise, close to the common grave, far from the elegant quartier of this city of sepulchres, far from all those fantastic tombs that show off death's ghastly fashions in the face of eternity, in a deserted corner along an old wall, under a great yew tree on which birdwood climbs, among the couch grass and the moss and the bindweed, there is a stone. This stone is no more exempt than the others from the leprosy of time, of mold, of lichen, and of bird droppings. Water turns it green, the air turns it black. It is not near any path, and no one likes going over that way because the grass is high and your feet get instantly wet. When there is a bit of sun, the lizards come out. There is all around a rustling of wild oats. In spring, the warblers sing in the tree. This stone is completely bare. The only idea in cutting it was to meet the bare requirements of a grave, and no further care was taken than to make the stone long enough and narrow enough to cover a man. There is no name on it for you to read. Only many years ago already, someone's hand wrote four lines of verse on it in chalk, lines that gradually became illegible under the rain and the dust, and that have probably now been erased. He sleeps, though fate for him was truly odd. He lived. He died when his angel was gone. The thing just happened of its own accord. As night comes on, when day is done.
The End. You've been listening to Les Misérables by Victor Hugo, translated from the French by Julie Rose, and narrated by George Guidel. We conclude this book with an essay written and narrated by Adam Gopnik.
One of the permanent and popular works of Western literature, Victor Hugo's Les Misérables is a rare book that is both a major literary novel and a miracle of popular entertainment. I write these words having just returned from a packed Boxing Day performance of the operetta version of the book by Schoenberg and Bublow, whose emblematic image of an embattled, wide-eyed nymphette, taken directly from the illustration of the character Cosette in the very first French edition, has by now become familiar to the world. 1,000 Christmas-sated New Yorkers sat, silent and wrapped with emotion, at the nearly three-hour-long rendition of Hugo's seemingly remote story of a failed armed revolt in 1832 Paris. Only the Charles Dickens of Oliver Twist and A Tale of Two Cities rivals Hugo as a popular poet who is also a great writer. And Dickens, for all his radicalism, worked more comfortably within the essentially progressive and ameliorative society he was settled within than Hugo, who wrote in exile at a time of autocracy in France, ever could. Dickens was responsible to reform and Hugo to revolution. Dickens was the storyteller to a nation. Hugo was the conscience of a people. A possibly apocryphal story relates that shortly after Les Misérables' heavily hyped publication, Hugo sent to his publisher a telegram with a single character. Question mark? The response came back in perfect symmetry. Exclamation point. That exclamation point was meant to suggest the commercial success of the book, but it remains intact as a reader's response, too. But readers expecting simply the operatic version of the novel, the tale of Jean Valjean and his implacable pursuit by Inspector Javert, counterpoised with the love story of his adopted daughter, Cosette, with the romantic revolutionary Marius, may be struck or puzzled by the novel as it really is. Les Misérables is, to use an image Hugo might have liked, a huge Gothic cathedral of a book ornamented with gargoyles of malice and flying buttresses of digression and some suspiciously restored-looking statues of saints. It includes a famous, long, descriptive analysis of the Battle of Waterloo, which plays very lightly on the action, essay-like paragraphs and pages on the meaning of names, the nature of genius, the importance of slang, and the social origins of prostitution, not to mention aphorisms of general applicability, only very gently tied to the material, but present on every page. The book seemed a little old-fashioned to critics when it was first published in 1862, at a time when Manet and Baudelaire were already working and the stenographic irony and elegance of French modernism was already alive. The book can still seem a little old-fashioned today. There is, as a consequence, a natural urge on the part of the reader to skip the gassy bits of Les Misérables and go directly to the dramatic bits. This would be a mistake, and one that this new translation by Julie Rose, which marvelously removes the yellowed varnish from Hugo's prose and gives us the racy, breathless, and passionate intelligence of the original, makes easy to avoid. The gassy bits in Les Misérables aren't really gassy. They're every bit as good as the good bits. They're what give the good bits the gas that gets them aloft. Victor Hugo wrote Les Misérables on the Channel Island of Guernsey in the late 1850s while in exile from the Second Empire regime of Louis Napoleon, Napoleon's nephew, and the autocratic mountebank who began to build modern Paris. It was in some ways a self-chosen exile. An amnesty had been issued in 1859, which Hugo might have taken advantage of, though at the cost of self-censorship on his return. But it was serious exile, not at all the self-saving, semi-theatrical exile that Voltaire, for instance, had known a century before in Switzerland. Hugo's was modern political exile, of the kind that countless Russian and German and South American writers would undergo in the next century, an uprooting with only a remote chance of ever getting home. And it was an exile earned as the accumulated result of almost 60 years of French history, years about as tumultuous as any 60 years of history have ever been. In France, since Hugo's birth in 1803, nearly every option of human governance, short, I suppose, of matriarchal Amazonianism, had been tried out. One regime after another, in rapid and disjointed succession, and often with the same people playing similar roles under different hats. The French Revolution in 1789, that great unlooked-for revolt against 1,000 years of hereditary absolutism, had been deformed into the Terror only a few years later, and then suddenly metamorphosed into Napoleon's empire, a thing not seen since the days of Alexander the Great, an imperial cult of charismatic conquest. That empire had ended, dramatically and abruptly, at Waterloo, the place where the French Revolution stops and modern French politics begins. This explains, perhaps, why Hugo spent so much time thinking about the mechanisms of that battle. It was followed by a restoration as inept as had been envisioned, but considerably less cruel than had been feared. This failed restoration led to the Second French Revolution of 1830, which brought a bourgeois king to the throne of France and created a crucial breathing space in which the civil society of France grew and became recharged. This was followed by the central event of Hugo's maturity, the great, specifically liberal uprising of 1848, which was in turn shut down a mere 2 years later in a coup d'etat organized by Louis Napoleon, returning an autocratic, but far from charismatic, empire to the French. It was a corrupt, business-friendly regime, a little bit like the Peronista regime in modern Argentina. No nation in modern history has seen so many political options played out over the space of one lifetime. And in Les Misérables, Hugo is writing a kind of account book of all those possibilities, and of the credits and debits they had incurred. Was Waterloo a triumph of reaction or a preamble to reform? Did the Restoration of 1830 betray the Republic or provide it with a crucial breathing space? Had the Revolution of 1848 been betrayed or fulfilled, ironically, in the only way it could be? Hugo's own life had been formed, in the spirit of the melodramatic vertigo he admired, by all of these experiences. His father, an atheist and Bonapartist, had been a high-ranking officer in La Grande Armée. His mother, on the other hand, with whom he lived for most of his boyhood, was a fanatic Roman Catholic reactionary. And Hugo's first poems and political writings were all for king and faith. His movement towards republicanism, so decisive in his later years, was in some sense a move away from his mother and poetry and towards egalitarianism and his father. With the proviso that he could only find republicanism convincing if it wore a romantic, almost a mystical garb. There was always a tension between Hugo's feeling for glory and dash and glow, those Napoleonic virtues, and his sympathy with reason and piety and fairness, those republican principles. Les Misérables is a kind of long argument Hugo is having with himself about whether the Republic will ever be sufficiently romantic. His early hero, Chateaubriand, the gloomy poet-prophet of French Romanticism, always haunted him. But he was trying to turn Chateaubriand's aristocratic pessimism into a form of liberal optimism, while keeping the same poetic intensity, trying to turn aristocratic pessimism into liberal optimism without making it fatuous. Though it must have been agonizing to live through these crazy oscillations, which didn't really end until the Fifth Republic in 1958, Hugo's particular, and particularly French, kind of humanism is rooted in them too. Shifting from pole to pole is a good way to learn that the world is round. Though unequivocal in his own politics, Hugo, as a novelist, accepts the contradictions of social life rather than trying to wrest them round to some simple idea of good and evil. For Hugo, civilization is a dialectic without a synthesis. Pointless riot and necessary revolution, romantic love and self-infatuated flirtation, poetry and slang all mixed together in a messy, human whole. He loves the coexistence of extremes, and he hates the golden mean. He writes, "For everything there is a theory that proclaims itself common sense, Fallant versus Alceste, the offer of a compromise between the true and the false, explanation, admonition, a somewhat arrogant mitigation that, because it is mixed with blame and excuse, believes itself to be wisdom, yet is often only pedantry." Yet Les Misérables, though touched by a young man's passions, is very much a mature writer's book. Hugo had been a figure in French letters for almost 40 years when he wrote it, whose interpolations and asides are part of a deliberate and achieved aesthetic. Hugo's first, instantly famous acts as a young writer involved his taking sides against French classicism, against the neoclassical unities and the chilly, elegant formalism that have always been far more alluring in France than in England, something imbibed there rather than inculcated. The first scandal connected with his name involved his now unreadable plays of the 1820s, Cromwell and Hernani, which made the case, forcibly, against neat plays with neat points, in favor of a Shakespearean drama of messy scenes and high emotion. Neatly woven stories were inadequate to modern times, Hugo always believed, while Gothic forms, with their shadows and side chapels and facade ornaments, spoke more directly to our experience. This paradox, central to all romantic art and fiction, where the Middle Ages are not the nostalgic past but the transposed theater of the present, informs his first great novel, Notre Dame de Paris, which we know as The Hunchback of Notre Dame. It luxuriated in its medieval setting while scoring its increasingly liberal points. Hugo's choice, yet again, of an implicitly Gothic form for Les Misérables, a form that is as potent in its ornaments as in its architecture and defies every notion of unity. This choice is neither accidental nor without a kind of politics of its own. Hugo does write in a way that will seem odd to the modern reader who is accustomed to the smooth psychological flow of the Gustave Flaubert or Henry James novel. Hugo doesn't just describe. He describes, then he dramatizes, and then he editorializes on the drama in a way that violates the decorum of the psychological novel as we have inherited it. He imagines his characters, sees what they do, and then charts his course on that basis. This all-over, freewheeling structure gives Hugo the opportunity to talk. What the reader is likely to remember longest and be stirred by most in Les Misérables is Hugo's own voice as the narrator, his wry, amused, impassioned, pluralistic, inclusive, running commentary on the action. At a micro level, Hugo's active delight at contradiction is expressed in the constant flow of antitheses that fill every page of the book and crowd its corners. The love of contradiction, expressed in sonorous antithesis, is there when he hymns the abandoned Napoleonic elephant monument in Paris that has become a squatter's delight. He writes, "Oh, the unforeseen usefulness of the useless, the charity of big things, the goodness of giants. The outsized monument that had once held an idea of the emperor's had become a pokey home for a little street kid." The same taste is evident in Hugo's wonderful descriptions of Paris in a time of revolution, when he writes, for instance, "Only such vast enclosures can contain civil war and an indescribably odd tranquility at the same time. People shoot at each other at street corners. A few streets away, you can hear the clinking of billiard balls in the cafes. The curious laugh and chatter 2 feet away from these streets full of war. The theaters open their doors and perform vaudeville. The fiacres roll along. People go off to dine en ville." The whole tone of French upper journalistic punditry still derives from Hugo's prose, by the way. The praise of the voluptuous cruelty of life or the horrible lucidity of journalism, and so on, which one can still bump one's shins against in any high-minded French magazine. Though some of Hugo's antitheses are merely sonorous, and a few are baffling, their constant drumming presence does suggest a view of life more accepting, more deeply tolerant of moral frailty, than our own Anglo-American liberalism, which still tends to put characters into neat boxes marked nasty and nice. This broadness is what Hugo's humanism consists of, and what makes the long editorial digressions in his books so passionate but still so convincing. It is in the opposites of his prose that what is romantic and old-fashioned, and what is modern and ever-contemporary, in Hugo meet. The doubleness in Hugo's voice, his fascination with what Robert Browning called the dangerous edge of things, the honest thief, the tender murderer, the superstitious atheist, means also that certain crucial scenes and actions in the book are a lot more complicated than we have chosen to recall them in popular memory. Hugo is a champion of the people, but he is far from a sentimental populist. His portrait of the Thénardier, the innkeepers who mistreat Cosette and then play a role on the barricades, is withering. Might have been written by that arch-reactionary, Balzac. More important, the moral dilemmas that Jean Valjean faces throughout the book are rarely simple choices between republican virtue and reactionary vice. Although Hugo is generally anti-clerical, he makes sure to help Valjean, at a crucial moment, rescued by a priest who, out of Christian compassion, pretends to have made him a gift of silver candlesticks that Valjean has in fact stolen from him. At another early turning point in the narrative, Valjean, in his disguise as Madeleine, a factory owner, has essentially escaped Javert's pursuit. Another man has been mistaken for him. Valjean's decision to go to the wrongly accused man's rescue and identify him also involves the loss of his own small factory and the destitution of his workers. It's not an obvious choice. Even the novel's climactic scenes on the barricades are not, as most people think or recall, images of the 1830 revolution, or of the glorious, if soon betrayed one, of 1848, but of a smaller, largely forgotten Parisian Fronde in 1832, which Hugo recognizes from the beginning as doomed, and probably pointless, and certainly from a narrow strategic point of view, counterproductive. This keys his great meditation on the difference between a riot and a revolution, a difference which Hugo, a passionate revolutionary, is willing to concede is much smaller and more contingent than one might like. In every case, where we recall a simple morality play, Hugo gives us a complicated essay on chance, contingency, and the cruel workings of moral necessity. Above all, while the popular imagination remembers Inspector Javert as an implacable and relentless pursuer, it is not, for Hugo, Javert's malice and mercilessness that drive him to hunt down Jean Valjean. It is Javert's absolute and, on its own terms, admirable commitment to justice, which Javert interprets as a commitment to the rules and their administration, to the parallel paper universe of abstract principles and absolute laws. At what is perhaps the real climax of Les Misérables, Javert's death, the drama is driven from inside by the poetry and is preceded and climaxed by a flurry of Hugo's antitheses. The crisis for Javert is that he is not able to accept the multiplicity of motive in human life. After Valjean's own mercy to Javert has persuaded the inspector to allow Valjean to carry Marius to safety, Javert, Hugo tells us, saw two roads before him, both equally straight, but he saw two of them. And this terrified him, for he had never in his life known more than one straight line. As Hugo writes in one of his most memorable aphorisms, thinking always involves a certain amount of inner revolt. I think, therefore, I doubt. To be alive is to be skeptical about one's own certainties. The complexity of Valjean's behavior is so frightening to Javert that it drives him to his own death, ornamented by a sudden shower of Hugo's antitheses. Jean Valjean threw him. All the axioms that had propped up his whole life collapsed before that man. Jean Valjean's generosity towards him, Javert, devastated him. A benevolent malefactor, a compassionate convict, offering forgiveness in return for hate, favoring pity over revenge, preferring to be destroyed himself to destroying his enemy, saving the one who had brought him down. This loathsome angel, this vile hero, who outraged him almost as much as he amazed him. Devastating generosity, loathsome angels, what destroys Javert is not his implacable lack of compassion, but his absolute certitude, which is inadequate, not merely to the complexity of life, but to Hugo's conviction that life is necessarily double, inexorably two-pathed, even when we struggle to stay on one. Yet, though Hugo has a complex view of the world, the popular memory isn't wrong to remember Les Misérables best as exhortation and example. In the end, Hugo kept French Republican liberalism from seeming fatuous by insisting that its acceptance of pluralism was not timid compromise, but a sign of wisdom. For Hugo, it is the rational, procedural, liberal Republican who alone has mystic romantic insight into the intrinsic doubleness of life. Hugo is a romantic, and he is a Republican. He believes in individual acts, even heroic individual acts, and he believes that political liberty is the precondition of that kind of heroism. At the height of the 20th century's calamities, Hugo's romantic republicanism could seem fragile and unconvincing. Beginning with Karl Marx himself, Marxists always condescended to Victor Hugo. Marx wrote that Hugo had failed to see the inevitable workings of the bourgeois scheme in the making of the Second Empire, and wrongly thought that the problem was Louis Napoleon when the problem was the Republic, which Marx thought was bound to be a fraud. Hugo, though, believed that liberty was not a bourgeois ruse, but a gift, like fire, that ought to be available to everyone. Hugo thought that the problem was not with the Republic, but with Louis Napoleon, who had betrayed it. The horror of capitalism lay in its cruelty to the poor. Reform the cruelty, and one could reconcile with capitalism. Any absolutist scheme that enslaved men was wrong. The Republican scheme, at least, pointed the way to their liberation. Though Hugo would have been, like Dickens, an exasperating man to talk practical politics with, and he was a failure when he attempted them, he had a vision of political life that remains remarkably sane and prescient. True republicanism for Hugo meant increasing the sphere of liberty in every arena of life, more freedom to rise, to sing, to act without fear, to accept contradictions without panic. And liberty meant breaking down the false fears among people. That's the romantic in Hugo, and that's the vision of Les Misérables. All men, Hugo tells us, are creatures of lust and will and cruelty, who can be broken not by slow education, but by sudden passionate bursts of empathy and conscience and indignation at the treatment of other human beings. Almost exactly halfway through Les Misérables, Hugo introduces an amazing extended metaphor of intellectual work, the life of the mind, as mining. Against the Enlightenment metaphor of intellectual work as tower making or bridge building, reaching upward towards heaven or the farthest shore, Hugo proposes that thinking is a kind of delving in the dark, a Dante-like descent towards something mysterious and unknown. At each level, the miner finds new jewels, but further down is a deeper inferno of pure will. You dig deep to reach wisdom, but if you dig deeper, you find raw hate and animal passion. It is a Freudian, self-canceling metaphor of the kind that modern literary critics love. The deeper into the darkness you go, the more light you shed. Presumably the light from the sky that comes down into the shafts, but that isn't clear or poetically convincing. But Hugo's real point is apparent. Sane minds are always forged over an inferno of passion and hatred. The job of the poet or philosopher or novelist is to open a vein into the mind that delves into the possibilities of the soul without getting us too deep into the rule of the will. It's dark down there, but the darkness is the only place where we can work. And in that darkness, something can be found. Accepting will, passion, lust, cruelty, rage, and violence, all the things Les Misérables depicts. Accepting these as inevitabilities of life, we can still believe in compassion, liberty, and light as the possibilities of civilization. The light of the mind is visible in human eyes, Victor Hugo tells us, and he means it. It's a little startling to think that Hugo's dream for France and Europe, albeit after a century of unprecedented cruelty and suffering, has actually now been brought to pass, a democratic France in a united Europe, allergic to warfare, with poverty reduced to mere pockets. Republican revolution completed doesn't look at all romantic. It's hard for Francophiles today, or for readers of Victor Hugo, to realize that all the petty bureaucratic schemes of Brussels and the depressing sonorities of compromised politics are the dreams that men died on barricades for. But they are. One need only look at life in South America or Asia, though, to see the more enduring conflicts between mass poverty and mere freedom, and more deeply, between the frightened insistence on authority and the love of liberty. As Mario Vargas Llosa's tribute to Hugo, The Temptation of the Impossible, has shown, Hugo's vision is still contemporary in this globalized world, reminding us that a courageous championing of the poor and a love of liberty are an intention. They're the same impulse expressed at different moments. Hugo's romantic republicanism, of which this book, Les Misérables, is the permanent manifesto, looks a lot saner than all the alternatives that have risen to replace it. The question marks remain. Les Misérables continues to provide the exclamations.
That was an essay on Les Misérables, written and narrated by Adam Gopnik. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.